hundreds of items out of their distribution packaging and putting them on the shelf, when you can keep them in the packaging and put that on the shelf one time, and people can just take it out themselves. And is there really such a great inconvenience in buying 4 tins of Heinz baked beans instead of 1 or 2, or a pack of 4 kitchen towels rather than a pack of 2? There is a quiet delight in the hearts of people who shop in Lidl, and with it a mild camaraderie. They have been changed. They buy in bulk and have discovered new names, new tastes, such as honey-flavoured walnuts from Denmark. Those freezers full of meat and pizzas and ice cream and seasoned rice, they feel almost affectionate towards. As if they were their own freezers. So little do things cost. There is no unnecessary music, no Lidl radio. It's just bare, barren, basic silence. And what does it matter that there is hardly any room at the tills next to the cashier's elbow to pack your goods, or that you have to queue for longer than you would in Japan, because there are only 2 cashiers, who, incidentally, are underpaid, and the women penalised for becoming pregnant, and denied the right to join unions, when you can walk away with a receipt for only £18.47 for a week's sustenance for a family of 4. You could even buy a tent at the same time if you wanted to. Lidl was a miracle. Michael had received a grocery text, without Kiss, as now standard, from Melissa in the afternoon, and was walking through the aisles looking for things, the things that she had asked for, and other things he might come across. At the moment, he was studying a large packet of tikka-flavoured crisps. He found Lidl comforting. It was a poor man's shop, an arcade for the working class. There was no pretense. Everyone was on the same level. All united in their recession-inspired economising. Also browsing was a dark-skinned man in long white Islamic dress and hat, pushing a trolley full to the brim, with an engrossed, good-natured look on his face. They came across each other again by the soya milk, where Michael was trying to decide whether or not he should get the unsweetened one. The man pointed at it, saying, "It's good. That one's very, very good." And although Michael was in his way for a second, there was no impatience, no trolley rage, which is rare in Lidl. They both just carried on about their shopping with a faint and fleeting brotherly connection. It was pleasant. It was soothing. On this particular cold and drizzly Friday night, Lidl was also a place to hide. He did not want to go home. Friday nights, traditionally assigned to partying and relief and enjoyment, were becoming increasingly depressing. He did not want to go home at the end of yet another week to the woman standing at the sink with a different mouth, to feel the wide emptiness that gripped the house after the children were in bed. He's so wanting of something, some loving heat, and Melissa wanting something too, but not him, something else, somewhere else. He did not want to live this way, and in addition to this, he was burdened with guilt about the thing with Rachel. They had seen each other a couple more times since that first time, once in her flat, again in the vicinity of the sink, the other time at a hotel, because of the sink, when he had gone as far as to book a room for the evening and lie to Melissa about where he was. Both times she had given him that heat, that fast enclosure that he needed, her soft and open body, and he felt that her heart was truly kind, but for him the quenching was purely physical. Afterwards, he was left with a profound sense of spiritual shrinking, a self-loathing that walked with him everywhere he went. And when he looked into the children's faces, the love in their eyes was hurtful. The power of it. It could not wash him clean anymore. It was easier, in fact, to look at Melissa, even though it was she he felt he had most wronged, because in Melissa's eyes there was no love to receive, and he could meet her in her blankness. Her withholding of what she and he might feel. He had never been with a white woman before, not to 100%. It was minimal, physically, the difference between them, his brown against her cream. The real difference was in her life, in her history. She could never know him completely, because she had not lived as he had lived. She did not belong to the brown world in which he had learned his fear, his fury, and his distrust. He found himself explaining things to her, and not liking that he had to explain. Whereas with Melissa, or with Gillian, all the others before, they already knew those things, and he didn't have to tell them anything. Even if they had not felt it themselves, they knew it, because they were of the same texture, or a variation of that texture. The difference between him and Rachel was inside, in the lenses behind their eyes, in the prisons of their minds, as defined by the outer side. And when he walked with her, the tension he felt, besides the obvious worry of being a cheat, was not what people might think of him, of them, as a possible couple, but that she did not know what he saw when he walked, the necessity and the laughter and the sadness of the blackness around him, the beauty of three black boys singing in the street yesterday, or the menace in a St. George's flag, hanging from a deep southern balcony, and in that same deep south, the never-ending sorrow for Stephen, for all the Stephens and the murdered ancestors of Stephen. Or the sweetness of that moment at the soya milk just now, that passing brotherliness. She would not smile. She would not know, as Melissa knew. Her life was a different language. Michael admitted to himself now, in the safety and the glaring lights of Lidl, that Rachel could not give him anything, no matter what she gave. Nothing lasting, nothing enough. Rachel was just a way of missing Melissa. Rachel was a way of needing Melissa. Melissa was the Hizzle. She still was the real Hizzle. While Rachel, anybody else, was lesser. And in realizing this, he understood that he had betrayed her. His empress. His mermaid. Pointlessly. Because he had known it all along. All that he was left with now was this need for her. Physical and in his soul. In his mind. He wanted all of her. He still did. And he wanted her to need him too, the way she had in the beginning. But the only way to make this even remotely possible, to return to a place where it was good, was to tell her about Rachel. The knowledge of this was like a strike coming out at him from the granola shelf, because it was only Melissa who ate the granola, and he was thinking very hard about which granola to buy, the orange and cranberry, or the coconut and tropical fruit. You have to tell her, the granola said, and you have to do it now, tonight, so that you can begin again with the truth firmly intact, with a perfect honesty. Truth is the only foundation for broken things, as earth is the only foundation for the rebuilding of a house. Go home. Go home to your house and tell your woman what you have done, and whatever happens, however she responds, take it as it is. Be prepared for anything. Let avalanching stones fall down on your shoulders. Let lava flow. It's the least you can do. And it was the coconut and tropical fruit granola, specifically, he felt, that was telling him this. So he put it in his basket and went immediately to the unspacious till. Down the high street, into the belly of Belgreen, he went, light rain falling on his forehead. The smell of the long winter in the air. The sound of the early weekend sirens. The tower blocks surrounding the green next to the library were lit up in their windows, along with the estate at the top of Paradise and the thin houses along the sloping bend. Mrs. Jackson was out again. He took her home again, and she stared up into his face the way she always did.
You look just like my son, Vincent.
He waited a while to make sure she stayed inside, though really he was stalling. Outside number 13, he paused at the door, frightened. The first thing he noticed going in was that there was some garlic hanging up by the front door, on one of the coat hooks. He heard the sound of bathwater. Melissa came walking through with Blake wrapped in a towel. She gave him a sharp snap of a smile and said, I'm going to put him down. He's tired.
I'll do it,
Michael said. He hadn't seen him since dawn. How had he grown through the hours? What new expressions on his face? You could miss so much. You could miss so many small moments of a whole boy turning into a whole man. He took him upstairs and dressed him for bed. He read him The Little Red Hen and laid him down in the second room. He watched him as he fell asleep, the diminishing of blinks, the extraordinary youth of him, his innocent face, untravelled by circles, lines and time. And he had the reassuring sensation that this was the only thing that mattered, the preservation of this small but crucial kingdom. Before going back downstairs, he got out of his work clothes and put the world away, so that he could concentrate fully on the task at hand. While he was doing this, he noticed half an onion lying on the windowsill next to his wardrobe. He picked it up, confused. The granola was still whispering to him.
Now. You have to tell her now.
There's something wrong with this house, Michael, Melissa said when he came into the dining area. She was picking up placemats, wiping them and putting them in a pile. Each time she added one to the pile, she pressed it down hard, as if it could walk away. I know it. Don't ask me why. I just know.
Why is there half an onion in the bedroom? I found it on the windowsill. It smells.
Did you move it? Put it back where it was. I put it there on purpose.
Why? And what's with the garlic? What's going on?
My mum said it would help.
With what?
She looked at him doubtfully. He wasn't going to understand. When she'd mentioned the night thing to him, he'd been dismissive, saying ghosts didn't exist. Even though she'd tried to explain to him that it wasn't a ghost as such, it was an energy, a pressure, a dark touch in the air. Have you noticed Rhea's hands lately? She said. They're really dry, like sandpaper. I keep reminding her to put shea butter on them, but it doesn't seem to be making any difference. They're dusty, like this house. Can't you see the dust? It's everywhere. And there's this white gunk on my flip-flops. I think we should move. She waited for him to speak, some encouraging response, which must not include the word cool.
I think you're overthinking it, he said, slowly putting the onion away from him on the table.
I knew you'd say something like that. The avenue of communication was clamping down. How would he find the channel for his crummy revelation? He must tread carefully and not let her think he thought that she was mad. He must obey the granola. It might not speak to him again with the same force, and then they would be lost forever.
It's an old house. He shrugged. And old houses have excess dust, I guess.
Which gets into a child's hands and dries them out.
What's the dust got to do with Rhea's hands? It's probably just eczema or something.
Man, just take her to the doctor. I take her to the doctor, Melissa said, waving a placemat for emphasis. Not you take her to the doctor. Why am I always the one to take them to the doctor? The dungeons, the baby beat, the fields in the middle of the day, the hospital, to little scamps.
Oh, Jesus. Not this again. I'm at work.
It's not like I'm... Yes, all right, I know. It's the unsolvable problem, isn't it? But anyway, I'm digressing. Did I ever tell you about Lily?
Michael held back his anger, obstructed as it was by this question. He didn't know what she was talking about. She wasn't fully present to be angry with. He sighed.
Lily who?
The girl who was here when I came to see this place that second time. Bridget's daughter. She had a limp. Well, she had strange hands. I remember them. They were very white, dry looking, almost powdery. Maybe...
What?
Maybe there's something here that... She was off-key, that girl. There was something wicked about her. It was like she wasn't... I don't know. Like she wasn't a real person in a way. Or she was possessed or something. I can't explain it.
Here, she trailed off, because Michael was looking at her in an erasing way, so that the strength of every word faded once it had entered the area of his auditory range.
I'm listening, he said.
No, you're not.
Yes, I am. You think that girl Lily's got something to do with the dust and Rhea's rash, and that...
It's not a rash. It's different from a rash. And anyway, it's not just that, it's her leg. Her hair caught fire. Remember that? Right here at this table. Ever since we moved here, there's just been... Oh, for goodness sake. Michael, will you please stop picking your dick when I'm trying to talk to you?
Like many men, Michael had a habit of adjusting his scrotum for comfort of positioning when he was at home, a private thing that he felt he had a right to do in his own house. Which was fair enough, but no matter how much she tried, Melissa couldn't stand it.
Look, he said, exasperated. I have a penis, okay?
I know, and I feel sorry for you. Why can't you just keep it to yourself, huh?
Why do you always have to make me aware of it in such a crude way?
This seemed like the perfect time, as they were in the subject area, to make his confession, which under the circumstances did not come out in quite the way he had intended, as there was a touch of nastiness in it. He wanted to make her feel bad, to remind her, indeed, of the importance of this very scrotum, its neglect at her hand, which had thus necessitated the excursion into another aperture. He said,
"Well, someone's got to be aware of it. In fact, someone has been aware of it. Someone else."
Then he stopped, losing scrotum, therefore adjusting it again in his anxiety, which made Melissa hate him more, actually, for this second adjustment in such a short space of time than for the content of his confession, which in this moment seemed quite by the by. She laughed at him.
"Oh, really? So what? You're seeing someone now?"
He became meek, like a little boy anticipating punishment, but there was a smugness in it. He wanted the punishment.
"I wouldn't say I was seeing someone. I'm not seeing her. There were just a couple of times when stuff happened. It's not still going on."
But she didn't seem to be listening anymore. She was neatening the placemat pile with a crazy exactitude, not even looking at him. Her face had faded from awareness and turned its dark corner.
"Those mats are straight," he said. "Do you hear what I'm saying to you? It was just a stupid glitch when I was feeling like I needed some attention."
He was thinking of the John Legend song in his head, Number One, the gist of which was going to be the finale of this explanation.
"And I wanted you to know about it, so that we could..."
Again, she laughed, giggled this time and shook her head. Melissa had a tendency to giggle when extremities of feeling were all cluttered together in her brain. Frustration, anger, hurt, disgust, hunger.
"Men think they're better than grass," she said.
"What?" "It's from a poem by W.S. Merwin. Men really do think they're better than grass. I understand exactly what that line could mean now. I didn't quite get it when I first read it, but I liked it, so I made a note of it. I mean, what makes you think I give a shit? Grass grows, trees stay standing, wind carries. You men think the whole world is your dick. Well, I can tell you that it's not. You can spare me all the details and the emotional backstory. Honestly, it's fine, Michael. You are free to wave it where you please. Frankly, it's one less thing for me to think about."
Michael was taken aback. Where was her lava? The avalanche? Where was her feeling? Her goddamn heart? "Hold on a minute. Do you love me?" he said.
"What?" She turned back to him from her departure into the kitchen, pausing in the doorway, against the fiery glow of the paprika floor.
"Do you love me?"
"Why are you asking me that now?"
"Because I seriously want to know. I'm interested. Go on."
His face was twisted, older than it had been just a few minutes ago. He looked shabby and weak. Melissa felt sorry for him, and she was suddenly full of an old image of their big love, and it made her sad. She missed him. She missed them. Somewhere she was hurt, because he had belonged to her through that love. But she couldn't quite feel the hurt as her own, couldn't work out whether it was there only because it was supposed to be there. Who was she, really, inside? It was as if there were two of her, one at the back, drowning, and one at the front.
"It's not exactly the absolute greatest time to ask me a question like that now, is it?" she said.
"Of course she loves you, Daddy,"
came a smaller voice from beyond, through the double doors, from the bathroom. The door kicked open, there was a clattering of crutches, and there was Rhea, naked, leaning with one arm on a crutch and the other hand holding the door handle. Her damp black curls were loose and sleek and falling down her face, like a slow, black, prehistoric waterfall. Her eyes were huge, bulbous and shining, the lashes like sooty sunrises. She was a vision of early brownness, the most beautiful broken thing they had ever seen.
"Hey," Michael said softly,
crouching, reaching out his hand to her, as though to a savior. She hopped towards him. He wanted to cry. There was something monstrous about seeing your child limping.
"Can you buy me a present?"
she said, when she reached him, when he was holding her hands and looking up into her face.
"For when my cast comes off."
Rhea knew, at this moment, that she could ask anything and would receive. She smiled for them, enjoying the attention. She knew her power.
"Just one," she said. "A small one."
Michael grabbed her, folding her into his lap, glancing down at her hands. Chapter 10. Sometimes it snows in February. In February, it snowed. It was a wild, white surprise. The snow fell for days in a confusion of climate. Long past Christmas in the wings of spring, the world was white. Ice on the corners, snow on the hills, traffic formed on the A roads and the back roads. The white stuff piled on rail tracks, halting trains and increasing signal failures. London does not know what to do with snow. It lives in hope that if it falls, it will do so lightly and leave smoothly, pulling away into ice, the ice disappearing into light, the streets returning to themselves. But this February, no. The fall began on the first day and came down heavy. Before it could disperse, there was more, another layer of difficulty which smothered the rooftops and the tiny surface areas of the thinnest of naked branches, making pretty winter trees. Cars would not start, and schools were closed. All the buses were cancelled, and Heathrow was closed. Even in the centre of town, in Piccadilly, and Covent Garden, and Trafalgar, those places whose endless activity had the power to nullify movements of weather, where the city itself was the defining factor of experience, making songs of rain, laughing and tooting in the face of sleet, even they could not shrug this off. It was covered, everywhere, the city, the suburbs, white. The Thames formed rafts of ice, and closest to the water was coldest of all. Damien was at work in Croydon, whose high metallic skyscrapers were also icing-capped, as were the tips of the telephone masts, the railings of the ugly flyover, and the ledge of the fifth-floor window that looked in on the blue-carpeted area of his desk. There were three other desks in this corner, belonging to Angela, Mercy, and Tom, who watched EastEnders religiously and owned a tie with prints of tiny pineapples on it. Angela and Mercy were talking.
"You know what happened?"
Angela said, her red earrings matching her red fingernails. Her black braids swirled into a bun.
"When you climb on people's heads to get to the top, well, guess what? When they all leave, you fall right back down to the ground."
"That's it,"
Mercy said, munching her mid-morning marshmallow, which matched her baby pink shirt.
"And you think someone's gonna come and put out their hand to help you up when you're down? No. They'll just be watching you and laughing, innit? You know? And not with you, but at you. What goes around comes around.
God is just," said Angela.
"Treat your neighbor as you would want to be treated yourself. Reap what you sow."
"Yes."
Their fingers clattered for a while over their keyboards, and Mercy offered Angela another marshmallow, which she accepted, even though, as everyone was aware, she didn't like marshmallows, because they were an unsatisfying, disappearing kind of food. But the snow was such that it caused aberrations of character and habit. The person they were talking about, Heather, had recently been promoted, using, they felt, underhand and treacherous tactics. They now decided that they were going to just go the whole hog and bitch about her.
"She's one of those people,"
Mercy lowered her voice,
"who thinks she's better than everyone else. Better than you or me. I hate people like that. Going around with an inflated sense of themselves, yeah? But you can't hide who you really are. Maybe that's why she wears so much makeup.
It's the wrong colour as well. Next time, look at her neck. You'll see it."
From there, they went on to talk about comfort duvets. The special, very old duvet that is kept by the television
and that you wrap around yourself in times of extreme pampering and hibernation. The perfect thing for this kind of weather, and the very item they would both be making good use of when they got home that evening. Damien listened to them. Rather, he heard them, hoping that they would not try to include him in their conversation, as they sometimes did. He was having particular trouble being at work today. There had been another in-law's Sunday roast with Patrick and Verena 2 days ago that he was still recovering from. Plus, he had a headache, and he resented more than usual the irritating nature of 9-to-5 existence, that you chat endlessly with the same people simply because they are stationed in your patch, that you come to know their daytime physical intimacies, Mercy's need for regular face powder and lip balm, Angela's chilblains and resulting office slipper wearing, what Tom and his keen hiker wife and their 2 boys were going to be doing this weekend. The snow was making everything more intense, louder, closer. He felt shut in. The heating was on too strong. The cold whiteness outside the window was both inviting and incongruous. At 11:30 a.m., the sandwich trolley arrived. A tall, silver vehicle, which lately had developed a squeaky wheel. It came at the same time every day, too early, at the lunchtime of children. The arrival of the sandwich trolley was Damien's proof that school was preparation for this kind of future, that from a very young age our training for captivity is in motion, the uniform, the 15-minute breaks, the ridiculous premature lunch. The sandwich trolley was the moment in his working day when he felt most strongly that his life required a dramatic change, a splintering, some kind of scandal or shock or tremor, when he most wanted to flee, to rip off his suit and run screaming from the building and go, where? Not home, not to Dorking, but to some loose, untethered place, any kind of ocean or other country, to a transcendental sphere where breath itself was marvellous and the breeze was open and palpable and there was nothing in the way of it to make it seem irrelevant. Instead, though, usually, he got up from his navy blue swivel chair like everyone else, stretched, and walked over. The hungry huddle bantered amidst the crinkling of plastic sandwich wrappers and packets of crisps and the jangling of change, returning to their desks afterwards, temporarily enlivened by the approaching meal, through which their computer screens would remain switched on, so that they could peer at them or enjoy a moment of unbridled and legitimate net surfing. Today, Damien could not join that brief, low-ceilinged voyage to the sandwich mecca. The sound of the crisp packets and the squeaking of the faulty wheel made his head ache even more. When Tom nudged him and asked him if he was coming to the trolley, he just wanted to beat him down. He looked out of the window, saw the clouds moving slowly across the firmament, and from somewhere very close, yet also seeming to come from the sky, he heard his father talking to him again, in that now frequent, harsh whisper, those same 17 words. How long will you go on living your life as if you were balancing on a ribbon? That was when he fled. He did not scream as he left the building. The screaming was internal. The cold, after the claustrophobic heat inside, made him shiver. And not just that, but the sharpness of everything, the enormous difficulty of each moment. He had not been to the grave yet. He had not laid flowers or knelt in the necropolis, or taken care of the boxes in the garage. He was afraid, afraid of the emptiness, of finding reflections of himself, and now they were hounding him, these small failures, so that he couldn't think straight. And yet it was so much more than that. Everything, everything was wrong. Specificities were fading. Foundations were crumbling. Indeed, he was walking on a ribbon, tripping, falling, with Lawrence on his heels, pulling him down along this white-cushioned southern pavement, on this alternative journey to another kind of sandwich, to Pret-a-Manger, which he now entered, realizing, beneath his turmoil, that he was nevertheless hungry. Damien was a Pret frequenter. He came here on such days when he couldn't handle the trolley. Inside all was retro and metallic, silver floor, silver cabinets, silver ceiling. He stared at the sandwiches. There were other people also staring at the sandwiches, in their neat office clothes.
their dark winter coats, considering what they wanted to eat in this single special hour. This small portion of freedom. Should it be meat or fish? Cheese or egg? Should he pick the sandwich that foolishly claimed not to be a sandwich by forsaking its bread, and therefore was actually a salad? Or should he just have a plain and honest salad, a niçoise, a bean feast? He stood there in this pressured Pret cluster, which was not really very dissimilar to the one in the office. It was just less friendly. Everyone was trying to appear as though they didn't care which sandwich they had, when actually they did care, a great deal. There was an acceptable amount of time that you could stand here for, between 30 seconds and a minute, and Damien was aware, as time passed, that his perusal was bordering on the excessive. The problem was that he was no longer staring at the sandwiches, but beyond them, into the silver of the cabinet, into the distractions and the reflections there. He saw a picture of Stephanie, early this morning, putting on her dressing gown to leave the bedroom, a reluctance in her movement suggesting defeat, dejection. He saw Lawrence's eroding dead skull beneath the earth, with soil clustered around it. Yet still, in the midst of all this, he was supposed to choose between chicken avocado and ham and Pret pickle. The more he stared, the more incapable he became of choosing. He glanced around and upwards. The ceiling swayed. A sweat was forming on his neck. Next to him, a black thing reached out and took a sandwich, a woman's gloved hand. It seemed a sinister hand. He realized that he was trembling. In an attempt to pull himself together, he closed his eyes and opened them again. Then he reached out, following the movements of the sinister gloved hand, and grabbed the first thing he touched, egg mayonnaise. He went quickly to the till and paid for it. Just as quickly, he went back out into the biting air and threw up on the pavement. The rest of the day was spent in a smog of ongoing qualmishness, until, at 5:45 p.m, he went to the station to get his train, only to find that it had been cancelled. The tracks were snow-clogged. There were red crosses all over the departure boards. He called Stephanie. He called Michael. Bell Green was only a couple of stops away, and some of the local lines were running. When there was no answer on Michael's mobile, he called Michael's house. Melissa picked up. She opened the door wearing a flared grey tracksuit with dance fit printed across the chest and white cord string and her slippers. She looked very young, yet older, closer into her face. Some recent darkness around the eyes, an argument with her smile, an uncertainty. Or maybe people just look different when they're at home on a weeknight, not expecting anyone special, and it's snowing outside in February. "Come in," she said. He started apologizing. "The trains. I'll be out of your way first thing, rocking up on you like this." "It's fine, Damien, honestly. It's really not a problem. Pass your coat," which she hung to thaw over the back of one of the dining chairs. He left his briefcase leaning against the wall by the door. "Where's Michael? Is he trapped as well?" He had expected to find him sitting on the sofa or coming out of the kitchen, but there was no one, just Venus and Serena Williams playing on a news clip, mythical, like shooting stars, distant yet familiar, and the radio on in the background. "I don't know where he is," Melissa said. "I mean, he's away with work, so I don't know." This was not strictly true. Michael was staying at the Queen's Hotel in Crystal Palace, on a temporary sojourn, away from unmarried life, at her request, after another argument that had started with his objection to the returning of the onion to the bedroom windowsill, but which was really about deeper things. The frost between them had thickened further after his confession. Michael had moved to the sofa full-time, because the master court wasn't big enough any more to hold their distance. For a while, they had lived purely by the light of the children. But during that last quarrel, Melissa had said, "I can't take this anymore. I can't live like this. It's making me sick. I want you to go."
"What about the kids?"
Michael had said. "I'll manage," she said. And so he was gone. Return date, as yet, unspecified. Which meant it was true. In answer to Damien's question, that she didn't know whether he was trapped in the snow or not. He could be. There were lots of hills in Crystal Palace. A train could have come off the tracks, or he might have stumbled in a ditch. Strangely, these possibilities were out of her jurisdiction. For now, he was not her man. He was a snowman, out there, and she was in here, in the crooked warmth, with her sleeping cubs, and now this other man, who was drifting around as if embarrassed by himself. "Why don't you sit down? Sit down, chill." Damien took this as an order, descending into the sofa at the last pop of Venus. He couldn't chill, though. It was weird being here without Stephanie and Michael. It was releasing all kinds of unacceptable feelings in him. "Are you hungry? I just ate, but there's some couscous left over if you want some." Couscous. Stephanie did that sometimes, cooked couscous. Couscous, Damien believed, was not meant to be eaten in the home. It belonged in North African restaurants, where they knew what to do with it. So there was not much hope for this meal, that she strode across the room into the kitchen to prepare for him. She put feta cheese on top of it. There were chunks of grey aubergine and carrots. She laid it out on a placemat, with a glass of red wine and a spoon. "Thanks," he said, sitting down to it. He wanted to ask for a fork, but he was paranoid that he might say fuck instead. "When I was growing up," Melissa said, relatedly, "we always ate rice with a spoon and fork." She was sitting on the edge of the chair, diagonally across from him with her leg tucked underneath her, watching him eat, making him more self-conscious. "But Michael and his family ate it with a knife and fork. So that's how he always eats it. So now, whenever I'm having rice or couscous or something like that, there's this confusion in me that wasn't there before, about whether to get a knife or a spoon to eat it with. Don't you think it's problematic how when you're in a couple you lose your grip on who you really are, on how you do things, on your own private culture? Do you know what I mean? Do you ever have this issue? I mean, what kind of a person eats rice with a knife? I don't want my children to grow up to be the kind of people who eat rice with a knife." She was looking at him with genuine interest. She wanted a response. She wanted him to engage with her on this. "Well," he said, "you definitely can't eat couscous with a knife." "Thank you." "But you do need a fork. You always need a fork, unless it's cereal." She gasped. "You haven't got a fork! I'll get you a fork. Of course you need a fork, to get the dregs onto the spoon. You see? You see what's happening to me? I'm confused. My inner makeup has been rearranged and now I'm spoiled. It's so sad." She went away and got the fork and gave it to him. He was chewing on some tough aubergine. It all tasted quite nice, but the textures weren't necessarily the best. "Actually, you know what?" she said. "I think I'll have some wine too, even if it is red. It's Michael's wine. He's the one who drinks red. I prefer white, as you know. But I'll have some red with you. It's no fun drinking alone." It was a 2/3 full bottle of Rioja. Soon, they were chilling at the table, postprandial, listening to Jaguar Wright. She had a sharp, hot voice, rafting over choppy beats. Melissa nodded to it intermittently as she was drinking. Damien had discreetly left a few bits of aubergine on the side of his plate. "Space is good," she was saying, in an upbeat rumination about coping with stress. "I like it when Michael's away. I feel different, brighter. Even this house feels different. I'm returning to myself. Experiencing myself clearly again, you know? It's like I'm not opaque anymore. I'm stronger, in fact. More positive. Positivity is the way to go. That's what my sister's always saying. It's our mental landscape that holds us back." Since Michael had left, Melissa and Carol had been chatting more on the phone in the evenings. "Mm-hmm," Damien said, nodding, because he could see that she really wanted him to get her. And he really wanted her to get that he was getting her. "Yep, space is the thing. Whenever you can get it, take it. I could use more of it myself. When's he coming back?" Thursday, she lied. "Maybe Friday? How are Stephanie and the kids?" "They're fine. They're good." But he didn't want to talk about Stephanie. He did not want to bring her, or anyone, into this perfect, warm, and temporary cave, where everything was just so. Melissa, all to himself, even if she was going on and on about Michael. But it was okay. It was just the two of them. They were alone together in a world of snow. Everything was still and soft. There were occasional sounds from the London outside, and he liked that too. "Okay, look," she said, suddenly. "I hate lying. Michael isn't away with work. We're having space." She made quote marks with her fingers, from each other. You know, space, space. That kind of space. There, I've said it. Everything got too much, so I kicked him out.
You kicked him out? Seriously?
Well... The Jaguar Right LP ended, and Melissa got up to change it. I didn't actually kick him out, per se, as in literally with my foot. I just asked him to get out of my face for a while, and he agreed. It was kind of a mutual decision in the end. I thought you would have known. Didn't he tell you?
No, I haven't seen him.
But I thought you were buddies. She found Susanna Bacca on the shelf and slipped her out of the CD case. The congas came in, the taps of the xylophone. In the kitchen, she washed up Damien's plate straight away so that dust wouldn't build on it. She still had the image in her mind of Michael packing his tiny blue suitcase, the way he'd looked at her as she'd walked into the bedroom. She had wanted to lie down with him on the bed, a last holding, but he'd given her such a hard, hollow look. From the way she was talking about it, so flippantly, Damien sensed that Melissa was fronting about Michael, that she was more upset about it than she seemed. There was a picture of them both with the children on the shelf above the television that he was trying not to look at.
"I guess he must be lying low," he said, assuming the same levity in his voice, though really he wanted to know everything, all the details.
He felt spurred, guiltily so.
"Anyway, I don't think Michael considers me a bona fide spar on that level that he'd go out of his way to call me up about something like that."
Not that he wanted, in any way here, by thus speculating to imply that Michael was not a close enough friend for it to be such a big deal if something were to happen here tonight. Something unrighteous. Something secret. No, absolutely not. Because that would be dark of him. But if only, in this sweet snow.
"What happened?" he asked, as she came back into the room.
"Oh, nothing and everything. He slept with someone, but that's not what happened. It was everything else that wasn't happening that happened."
"Wow, he cheated," Damien said.
Melissa looked at him, bemused, a little condescending. "He doesn't belong to me. Fidelity is so overrated. I think it's childish the way people think of it."
"So it doesn't bother you?"
There was a suggestion in his tone, a hint of expectation, that made Melissa see him for the first time in a different way. She noticed the roundness of his shoulders and the thickness of his waist. There was a rich warmth to him that she had always thought of as brotherly, but now it was alluring, rugged. His fingers were very thick, not smooth and elegant like Michael's. She studied them, for long enough for him to notice. The Rioja was going to her head.
"If it bothers me, it's my problem, not his," she said.
Damien could feel a wide, foolish smile trying to take over his face, and he suppressed it. It was just that he was content, being here in her company. So different from how he'd felt earlier today, and the way she'd looked at him just then had given him something. It had lifted him.
"I think I had a panic attack today," he blurted.
"Did you? How come?"
"I don't know. I was trying to buy a sandwich and I don't know, I freaked out."
"Do you know what caused it? Was it something to do with the sandwich? Michael hates egg mayo. It turns his stomach." She was like a record on repeat. "Michael, Michael, Michael. Sorry," she said, realizing, as Damien got up from the table. There seemed to be a collusion emerging between them. Unspoken, a secret two-ness.
"It was egg mayo, funnily enough," he said, turning away from her towards the bookshelves. Melissa shuddered. It was getting colder. She went to adjust the heating and wrapped the blanket off the sofa around her, by which time Damien was sitting on the floor looking through the records on the bottom shelf. His shirt had come untucked at the back. His back was like a warm mountain, thick and rotund.
"You've got some classics here, man. Millie Jackson. My dad used to listen to her."
My dad. Had he actually said that? It sounded absurd coming out of his mouth. Yet he'd said it so naturally. He was shocked.
"Why don't you play it?"
Melissa said. She showed him how to change the speed on the record player. Millie sloped in, slinky, white with the snow, in her white jumpsuit and long cape. The voice took Damien right back to a time when Joyce, he and Lawrence were sitting at the table playing blackjack. It was all crisp edges and clusters of colours in his head. Joyce's purple cardigan, the gold buttons, the flowers on the table, the orange curtain, the vividness, the immediacy of the image brought tears to his eyes.
"Are you okay?"
He was hunched on the floor, staring at the turntable. He breathed deeply. A long, violent exhale. God, it's amazing how music can make up your life, your whole life, and bring it back to you in bits. Things you thought you'd forgotten. She agreed with him, and he felt that she was gently listening to him. "Are you thinking about your dad?" The song played on, both of them inside it. "It just struck me that he was alive once. I mean, really alive. Before he died in his life. Do you understand what I mean? That's what happened to him. He was already dead."
"The greatest challenge in life is not to die before we die," Melissa said.
"I read that somewhere. It happens to a lot of people." She was going to add, "I think it's happening to me," but didn't. They were both a little drunk by now. They were next to each other on the rug with their backs against the sofa in the zigzag lamplight. Damien wanted to put his arm around her, to hold her, just for a minute. He'd never talked like this about his father to anyone, and he felt lighter, as though a touch could carry no guilt, no reproach.
"I think my dad's going to die soon," she said.
"He's getting frailer and frailer every time I see him. I should go and visit him more."
"Why don't you?"
She paused. "It's a long story.
It's in the past, and I don't like to go there. Lots of people have difficult childhoods.
The important thing is how you rise above it to meet yourself."
"Where did you read that one?"
"Nowhere." There was an extended silence. For the dead and the undead. The vinyl too fell silent in the space between the songs. Melissa finished her wine.
"Have you tried writing about it?" she asked.
"About what it feels like in a diary or something. It must rock your foundations when a parent dies, no matter how you felt about them or how close you were. You should just splurge it all out. That's what I used to do. It helps."
Damien had never kept a diary. "It seems depressing. Staring your problems in the face like that, writing them all out. I have written about him, though, in a way, a long time ago. I wrote a novel that was sort of based on him."
"Did you?" She sounded impressed. "Did you finish it?"
"Kind of. Not properly. It fizzled out in the end."
"What's it called?"
He was shy. "It doesn't really have one title. There were two or three of them. Cannon and the Storm was the main one."
"Cannon and the Storm.
She rolled it around on her tongue.
"Cannon. That's an interesting name. Is Cannon the father?"
"I like it. It's a good title. It's intriguing."
"So it gets your approval." Damien was overjoyed. It was beginning to come to him again. The finger-tingling writing feeling. The cocooning thrill of it. She even said, "I'd like to read it sometime." Glancing over at the empty bottle on the table and draining her glass again, even though it was definitely finished.
"Are you serious?"
he said. Yeah, seriously, email it to me.
Okay, I might.
He would.
Once I've got it all together.
God, I don't know how anyone could write a novel. It must take ages, all those words, all those sentences.
She was getting up, clinging to the edge of the sofa.
I couldn't do it. 2,000 words is about my max.
The music had ended again, throwing the room into emptiness.
You know what I'd really love right now? She said.
What?
A cigarette.
I didn't know you smoked.
I don't. I used to.
I've got some Marlboro Lights if you want one.
I didn't know you smoked.
I didn't. I gave up.
On giving up, that is. On New Year's Day, to spite the resolution culture.
Don't stop. Start. Stop denying yourself and live. Life is long, not short. Smoking kills? Life kills. This was Damien's current philosophy, and it had been enabling abundant Marlboro Light puffing in the driveway at home and subsequent gum chewing to hide the smell, which wasn't working. Melissa tried to fight the craving but gave in.
Let's have one. I don't care anymore, she said. We have to go outside, though. You know it's minus out there.
She went to check on the children. Blake was sleeping through now, returning to her the night. It was Rhea who had been restless recently. She had tried to sleepwalk downstairs at 2 a.m. with one crutch, before the cast was removed, and Melissa had found her under the skylight. But now she was sleeping deeply. They had gone out in the snow today, in the morning, and on discovering that the school was closed, they had gone on towards the park, along the silver birches, in through the gates. It was deserted, the snow a white floor, untroubled. Amazed, Rhea had run across the field, a decreasing figure advancing towards the tenements, her small, dark footprints a trail of recent Rhea's. There was a slight limp in her left leg, which the doctor had said would disappear in time. And they had made snowmen, a family of three, in the garden, who stared with their hard sultana eyes as Melissa and Damien lit up. Their noses were carrots. One of them, the tallest, was wearing Michael's scarf. Other inanimate beings in the garden were the yellow teddy bear sitting stiff-haired on the red bench, and the toy figures in the white-topped playhouse. The sky was cold and lilac. The snow was turning to ice, making the snow family lose their definition. The wind chime sang as the ice wind blew.
Are you sure about this?
Damien said when he offered the pack.
I'm sure.
She took one. It felt big between her fingers. The first inhale was air spinning, gorgeous against the wine. They had found more to drink at the bottom of the fridge. A half bottle of leftover Liebermelsch, which was pleasantly sweet.
Sometimes when you want something, you just have to let yourself have it, she said.
For Damien, too, it was one of the best cigarettes he had ever smoked.
Just don't blame me if you start again.
I won't. I don't want to get cancer.
If you smoke it to only halfway down, it's not as bad. Most of the cancer's in the butt.
The arms of their coats were touching, which didn't seem a thing. They blew up at the sky, the skeletal aerials and the silhouettes of the chimneys. Long clouds lay out, some moving and pink and slipping away, and at one end, to the south, the moon slid full, round and golden into a case of silver wisps until it was swallowed, whole, and all that was moving was a fading glow like a sun reduced to a common star. A bay tree, blackened in the darkness, stood up above the fences, watching over them with its still, black leaves.
I like it out here, Melissa said. Sometimes I come out here at night to think, to be myself. It's not that private. I feel like people are watching me from the windows over there, but I can hide behind that tree.
She looked up at it. That tree is my friend. It understands me. It knows.
What does it know about you? Damien said.
Everything. He was looking at her profile. She could feel him looking at her in a certain way. It reminded her of how Michael had looked at her in Montego Bay, waiting for her to answer his questions. Everything I was and what I am now,
she said. Whatever that is, I'm not sure I know anymore. I seem to be losing a sense of it. It's quite frightening. Do you ever feel like that? Like you're losing track of who you are? Most of the time I feel like that. She turned to him, stealing her profile away, emboldened. And you're looking for yourself, but can't find it. You don't even know where to look anymore. Like you're groping around in the darkness. Dominant in her face was that look of extreme youth he'd seen when she'd opened the door to him. The face of a child, the facade all gone. It's because we're in the wrong place, he said. It's because we're not living how we're supposed to live. Why, though? Why don't people live the way they're supposed to live? It should be the easiest thing in the world. He shrugged and lit another cigarette. It's scary, that's why. So quickly does smoke enfold. Melissa wanted another and motioned for one. She took it in deep, right to the bottom of her throat before blowing back out, adding smoke clouds to cold clouds. The wine and the snow and the smoke wore a red and white dance inside her, and she felt carried with it, afloat. "Can I tell you a secret, Damien?" she said. "Yeah, of course." "I've never told this to anyone before. I'm almost afraid to tell it to you." "I won't tell anyone, I promise." "It's not that. It's not that kind of secret. I'm just worried something bad will happen if I do." But she wanted to tell it, to say it out loud, in this quiet, pure white, so she moved her fear out of the way. "When I was younger, before I had children, before I met Michael, when I was around 24, I used to have this feeling. I'd had it all through my life, right up until about that age, 24. That's the age when I can still remember it being completely intact, as much as a feeling, a sense of something can be intact." Her hands were shivering, partly from the cold. She took another sip from the Liebfraumelch, followed immediately by another inhale. "You might find this strange or arrogant, maybe. It was a feeling that I was protected by something. A kind of guide. A guardian angel, if you want to think of it like that. I had my own angel watching over me. It walked with me. She, I think it was most like a she, was there. Everywhere I went. Through everything that happened. I felt like I was untouchable, invincible. I used to walk across roads without looking, convinced she would stop the traffic. I used to take all kinds of risks with myself." "What kind of risks?" "Oh, things I wouldn't do now. Staying in strange men's flats, getting into meat vans with them, jumping off..." "Meat vans? Ah, another long story." "Okay. Anyway, the point is that I'm scared now, and I didn't used to be scared. I used to live off my instinct. The instinct was guided by the angel and the angel by the instinct." Before Michael had left, Melissa had taken to going out alone in the evenings. She hadn't felt like seeing friends. She'd go to the V&A, to galleries, to look at pictures, to see if maybe she could find it, what it might look like, this angel that she had always taken for granted. At the Tate Modern, she had found something, a painting by Gauguin, of a woman standing facing the